are listening to Radio Albion.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the show. We're live on Odyssey, Rumble and Entropy, and tonight we're here live for our film club, and tonight's review is K-pop Demon Hunters. We've all watched it. Myself and Laura, as we have young girls, have watched it hundreds of times each, so this to us is like an everyday occurrence. If I don't hear at least one of these songs per day, it's a strangely quiet day in the house. That's how much this film has penetrated the minds of young girls here in England. And I've got to admit, disclosure before we go any further, I don't dislike the songs. I've got to say, I have been quite addicted to some of these songs myself. They are quite catchy, and I have been known to listen to them in the car when driving the children around. So that's the disclosure out of the way. Anyway, it's going to be a fun, lighthearted stream. If you would like to share the stream, if you would like to put it out there on X, if you'd like to put it out there in places I can't, that'd be appreciated. And if you want to make a donation during the stream, you can do so via Rumble or Entropy. All donations are gratefully received. Don't feel any pressure on a Sunday night to donate. These streams are more lighthearted. We do them for fun. We do them because people like to kick back on a Sunday night and hear something different. We have an array of different chilled out Sunday night streams. But if you want to send a gift or a donation, it is very much appreciated. And any comment or question added to a donation will be read out live on the show. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links in the description below. And you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. Anyway, let's get into this. This was sort of a last-minute film choice that Laura suggested. So if you want to blame somebody for this, and if we get terrible viewing numbers, it's all Laura's fault. So that was why we were doing this. But I think it's going to be an interesting discussion, and I think it's going to be something that's going to be fun to talk about. And next month, we'll be back to more serious films. Anyway, let's go around the group, starting with St. Harrison, then Nativist, then Laura. And let's start with, what were your first impressions of this film? Not the themes, not the quality of the film, et cetera, not the musical numbers. We'll do all that stuff first, then we'll go into the themes. But what were your initial impressions? We'll throw that over to you, St. Harrison, and go around the group.
Evening all. Now, unsurprisingly, I hadn't ever seen this film, nor had any intention of seeing it. So when it was suggested by Laura, which later turned out to be a joke, it was already too late. It was already downloaded and ready to watch. So I watched it with Mrs. Harrison today. I'm ashamed to admit, I actually enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I'm not going to say I'm going to watch it again. However, I am surprised.
Well, that's not what I was expecting. Nativist, I'm sure you're going to be more acidic. How are you doing, my friend? What were your initial impressions of the film?
Evening, everyone. Well, it was about this time last year that I was flying to South Korea from Japan because it was a lot cheaper to fly home that way. I ended up spending quite a bit of time there. And I don't have the highest opinion of the South Koreans. And this film confirmed everything that I'd been thinking about the weaknesses of their culture. So as we went through the film, I started to get excited about talking about it. And I was a bit skeptical of the choice at first. But as we went through, I thought there's an awful lot to talk about. So I'll leave it at that for now.
Laura, as a mum of two girls, what was your initial impressions when you knew this was going to be a big part of their lives?
Well, good evening, everyone. And I do apologise. I did genuinely say K-pop Demon Hunters as a joke, thinking that you'd just laugh. And then I came back to the chat a few hours later and you were all like, yeah, I'm watching it and here's my opinion. So I was like, uh-oh. But yeah, it's an easy night for me because I have seen this film many, many times. I have a four-year-old girl and an almost two-year-old girl and they both enjoy it. So yeah, I think Sam showed them it at first and I was like, oh, what's this? And when you've got kids, you sort of end up, you never really watch something all the way through. You just watch like little snippets of things here and there. But it did catch my attention and I like the animation style and I like the songs and stuff. So I do think it's a good film. I don't think it's the best film ever made or the best kids film ever made or anything like that. But I do think it's a good film and it's just won two Oscars.
Well, having a daughter that's a little bit older than Laura's daughters, my daughter's six going on seven, this is a massive, massive part of her life. And my first introduction to this was actually the songs, driving around and her requesting the songs in the car. And I was very much like, oh, God, this is going to be awful. And as time went by, I found myself sort of tapping my toes more and more to the songs, enjoying them, looked into it a little bit, watched some of the music videos before I watched the film, but I actually quite like it. I've got to admit, I like the songs. I think they're quite catchy. I like the style of the animation, which we'll talk about soon. I thought all of that was pretty damn good. And I started enjoying this a lot more than I thought I would. And my initial impressions of it were a bit like, oh, God, what's this going to be? But I was wrong. So first, let's talk about the animation and the character designs, because they're not sort of traditional Western archetypes. Obviously, this is set in Korea, and it paints Korea quite interestingly as an ethno-state. It doesn't show, there's not blacks, there's not other people. They're all Koreans. But I really like the art and animation in this film. And one thing I really like about it is how expressive the characters are, how they pull silly cartoonized faces when they find somebody attractive or they're about to eat a really tasty meal. I find it all quite whimsical, quite fun. And I actually, watching it, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought. And I know it's a computer animated film, it's not sort of traditional animation, but I did find it really engaging. I think sometimes computer animated films can lack a certain degree of emotion. The characters can come over a little bit flat. It's hard to add, I think it's easier to put emotion into traditional animated films, sort of traditional Disney films, the old Disney films. I think the quality of the animation was superb. And putting emotion into those films seemed a lot easier than putting it into these sort of Toy Story, Shrek-style films. But I thought the way they handled this, the animation was fantastic. And the way the characters were drawn, they're funny, they're whimsical. I really like all that. And I've got to say this about the animation. There didn't seem to be anything that I thought was overly sort of inverted commas and this is worn into the ground, but didn't see anything to be particularly woke. The three main characters are all sort of drawn to be very attractive, slim, athletic, quite confident, enjoy life. I didn't think there was anything in there animation wise that I found objectionable. What do you guys think about the animation?
No, I thought the animation was really good. And like you say, they use 3D animation, so the characters are far more expressive compared to like Frozen that we watched a couple of months ago. But no, there's absolutely no complaints in terms of the filmmaking at all. And yeah, the only like fat characters you saw in it was the three blokes who shouldn't be anywhere near, what was it? Humantrix, Huntatrix concerts, like the proper soys that I know Navis is going to lay into shortly. But no, they're all slim. There's no fat. There's no ridiculous LGBTQ nonsense in it. They know their audience and they know that wouldn't have worked. So they weren't forced into it, even though it was a Netflix film, which made me feel a bit bit of trepidation when that came up at the start. I thought, oh, there's going to be some black in there and what have you. But no, no complaints.
Nativist, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought it was fine. Well produced. I mean, it's not like Studio Ghibli or, you know, the really great Japanese animes, but it's well produced. You know, constant energy. You never feel bored. It's well paced. Do you ask about the characters specifically? I mean, I would say that the girls are representative of the kind of Korean feminism that's going on now, but I'll elaborate on that later.
Actually, it was the animation that first sort of caught my eye with this film, and it's really unusual and unique. I mean, to be fair, I don't watch a lot of like East Asian cartoons, so maybe it isn't unusual at all, but I feel like it's a cross between like anime and Wallace and Gromit or something, because it seems like the characters are actually 3D models, but obviously it's animated, and it moves well and it looks well, and I've never seen a film that's animated like this before. I think it looks really beautiful.
So high praise so far. What do people think of the music? Because obviously we can't really go through this without talking about the music. I've got to admit, at first I was like, what is this? But over time, all these songs have grown on me. I know them pretty much all off by heart, except for the sort of second Sarja Boys song where they're in full sort of demon form taking everyone's souls. That was the only song in the film that was sort of new to me. But the main songs like Golden, Takedown, How It's Done, I knew them pretty well. I quite like the songs. I found them to be catchy enough that when my daughter's not listening to them, they're often in my head as well. And we listen to these everywhere we go. What do you guys think of the actual music? Because with it being a musical, have we done a musical before? I'm sure we have, but the songs are obviously an important part. These are good. And one thing I liked about this, and I've got to throw this is more sort of praise really, but I often find myself watching musicals and truly despising them. But I thought, despite this being a musical, it never really overdid it with the songs. None of the songs sort of outstayed their welcome. And it wasn't one of those musicals where it got boring. I actually found like it was pretty damn interesting throughout. And the songs popped up when they needed to be, and they didn't overdo it with them. So they were all of pretty high quality, to the point where I'd go as far as say every song from the film could more or less be a single in its own right. What did you guys think of the music?
Like, the first song in the film was that rap, wasn't it? And it just sounded like something you'd hear from the BET Awards. It was just horrible black music. And at this point, Miss Harrison just afterwards went, I'm enjoying this. And I just thought, this is awful. Obviously, I started to enjoy the film afterwards. The only song I remember from the film is Golden, because they play it repeatedly throughout the film as an instrumental whenever things get a bit quiet. So it is very catchy, but I don't remember any of the other songs. And to be honest, I'm quite glad about that. I'd be happy to watch it without any of the songs in it.
Yeah, I thought the songs were solid. I won't be watching it again, so I don't get them stuck in my head. But, you know, they were quite whimsical, comical, a little bit self-aware. It all worked pretty nicely.
Yeah, I really like the songs. And I think when you've got kids, you just sort of end up embracing the cringe a little bit. And if you don't, you'll go mad because you've had to listen to Let It Go by Frozen a million times. So you just end up sort of like getting into stuff so that they don't annoy you. And I really like the music in K-pop Demon Hunters. Both my girls like it. We listen to it in the car quite a lot. I mean, Golden is an absolutely massive, massive hit. Like I said, it's just won Oscar for Best Original Song. And it was number one in 30 different countries. Any time that the radio's on, you know, if I'm in, like, I don't know, in the car or in a hospital waiting room or something, Golden is always playing. It's such a huge song. My daughter actually goes to dance class, and she asked the teacher if they could dance to K-pop Demon Hunters. And when she put Golden on, every single child in the class screamed because they all loved it. That's how popular the music is, really. And I like the music. I like the first song, how it's done. And I like Takedown, the one when they're fighting on the train. Golden's obviously a good one as well. And it's not my style of music. You know, I like Arctic Monkeys, Oasis, Kasabian, that kind of stuff. I suppose I take music quite seriously. But like I say, when you've got kids, there are these songs that you just end up listening to again and again and again. And you just kind of end up embracing them because you'd go mad if you didn't. But their voices are amazing as well. I think we have to mention their voices, like the notes that they can hit. I get about halfway through Golden and then my voice just stops because I can't get any higher. But yeah, I think the music's really good.
So far, pretty high praise for the film. But we'll come on now to the themes of the film and what people thought about this, because I'm quite discerning when it comes to sort of what my daughter can watch. And there's certain things I really don't want her watching and certain things that I'm a lot happier for her to watch. Now, this was a film that's pretty huge, as Laura said, and that means everybody's into it. Everybody's watching it. Everybody knows about it. And in those cases, it's a lot more difficult to say no to a child, because at some point they're going to see the film anyway. They're going to ask about it. Their friends are dressing up as the characters for birthday parties. So if you take a little girl to a birthday party and it's fancy dress, there's going to be at least one little girl there dressed as a K-pop demon hunter. And in fact, one of Sophia's friends, she had a birthday party recently and it was a K-pop demon hunter's birthday party. So everyone went dressed as one of the characters from K-pop Demon Hunters. I mean, there were kids, maybe not everyone, there were kids who went in other fancy dress things, but it was a K-pop Demon Hunters themed birthday party. So it was heavily, heavily tilted to little girls dressing up as the characters from the film. And I actually didn't have any problem with that. So I watched it and I was actually quite happy with the themes pushed in it. And I personally didn't find much to be particularly corrosive. Now, I'm sure Nativist is going to say something different to this, but I have seen films where there's sort of heavy feminism, there's LGBT, there's sort of propaganda about all manner of things. And the first thing I've got to say about this is there was no multiracial stuff here. You know, the girls, you know, none of the girls were dating a big black guy. Everybody in the film was Korean. There wasn't wave after wave of obesity or LGBT or fat pride or stuff that was all about inclusivity or diversity. And I know that the main characters are not white, but it wasn't really pushing that messaging that a lot of, modern Hollywood slop does. And I know this is a completely different film, but one of the first films that I remember showing my daughter was How to Train Your Dragon. And she really enjoyed that. And when they announced there was going to be a live action version of How to Train Your Dragon, I was like, she's definitely going to want to see this. She loved the main female character in that, who was sort of really tough and really cool. And she was like, yeah, I definitely want to see that, Dad. And then we didn't go to see it. And we didn't go to see it because they did a race swap on the main female character. So I was like, well, that one's in the bin. We're not going to go and see that. And I know this is only one film in a franchise. There may well be a sequel. I'm sure there's going to be a sequel. And if there is a sequel, it might suffer from the fate of many sequels when they get more money pumped into them, when there's more pressure put on them. I don't know. But on the surface, the usual Western multiracial propaganda, LGBT propaganda and feminist propaganda, I thought was kind of lacking in this film, which is something that obviously I really, really like. Now, there is an argument that the main characters are all female, they're acrobatic, they've got weapons, they're doing backflips, they're killing monsters. And you might say, well, that's a bit of a feminist power fantasy in itself. But obviously having a daughter who, you know, is very, she's very outgoing, she's very active, she's someone who likes to be physically active, she likes to do, you know, sports and outdoor activities. I actually quite like the three main characters being acrobatic, outgoing, sort of warrior type females, but not warrior type females who lose their femininity, and also not warrior type females that go down that warrior slut archetype. And I know some people can say, what's the warrior slut archetype? Well, if you play computer games, you're you watch certain sort of male fantasy material, you know, you'll have a woman with unbelievably large breasts in very, very skimpy clothing with a huge sword, and she's sort of like warrior slut. But none of these girls are slutty. None of them are overly exposed. They're not sexualized through the film. There is romance in the film, but there is a lack of sort of sexuality, innuendo or anything like that, which is also nice. You know, if you've got your children there and you're watching a film with them, you don't want it jam-packed with innuendos, do you? You don't want it jam-packed with sexualized material. And I think one thing that Hollywood loves to do with children's films is drop things in that are age inappropriate. And we'll talk about some other themes later, but I thought in terms of wokeness, I didn't think this was bad. And I certainly wouldn't say to parents, you shouldn't show this to your children. I mean, it's obviously it's up to every parent what they choose to show their children. But I thought this was really good in that way, and certainly a lot better than sort of Hollywood and, you know, your usual animated slop that comes out of Western studios. What do you guys think? Start with you, St. Harrison, and go around the group.
No, I'd have to agree. I mean, with the three girls, if this had been a Western film, one would have been a leather, one would have been a they, them, and the other one would have been normal. But, of course, it's Korea. That's not going to happen, although it probably does. And, yeah, them being, like, amazing fighters. The target audience isn't people of our age. Let's be honest. It is for young kids who like that kind of thing, so don't think too much into it. And, yeah, they're not slaggy. They have some admiration for the boy band, like they're obsessed with his abs and their eyes start bulging out and what have you. And it's all fairly harmless. And even one of the like key premises that they have one of the songs about is like, don't show your problems and fears, which is just what you want. There's none of this. Oh, embrace your problems, embrace the things that make you different. No, there's none of that. Just keep it covered. Get on with the job, which is a fine lesson for young kids. And also avoid people in black hats.
Avoid people in small black hats was the the actual message. But anyway, we'll come to that later. Nativist, what did you think to sort of the common woke propaganda that you get in sort of Hollywood slop from Western studios? I mean, interestingly, talking about this, it's a different film, but we've just had a major Hollywood blockbuster flop called The Bride, starring, unfortunately, Christian Bale, which was meant to be this feminist power fantasy about the Bride of Frankenstein, putting the Bride of Frankenstein first, pushing all the agendas that they usually push, and it flops massively. And we are seeing this major pushback. You know, big studios now are still spending hundreds of millions on these feminist power fantasy films. They're all going down like the Hindenburg. And this, for me, is quite a nice sort of pushback to that. What do you think, Nativist? Because you're not as hot on this film as we are, but did you think it had any woke stuff in it that you disagreed with?
Well, where to start? I think a lot of white people tend to think of East Asians as quite white in mentality and ability. But that is far from the truth. these people lived in Siberia for 40,000 years in, you know, like minus 50, minus 40 centigrade conditions. And then after they moved south, they farmed rice for 10,000 years. Now, these contexts require a huge amount of collective politics and, you know, all the other social tools that you use to control a people. And they are evolved for those conditions. They are extremely collectivist, extremely conformist, extremely status oriented, and they are very good at social masking, which is why I think whites don't recognize them as being particularly other. But if you go to these places, I've been to all three of the major East Asian nations, China, South Korea, and Japan, you will notice that their status orientation is completely oriented to trying to take elements of the West and incorporate it into their culture. Everywhere you go in Japan and Korea, there are French bakeries and cafes. There are queues of women out the door trying to take photos of the latest French cakes. In China, a Chinese businessman will spend $5,000 on a bottle of Bordeaux Rothschild Lafite and mix it with Coca-Cola. Everything is for showing off. And in the case of K-pop Demon Hunters, essentially the plot is written by a Korean woman that grew up in the West, and she is completely rejecting patriarchal Korean tradition and its accompanying its theological basis in favor of a Western, even Judeo-Christian feminist and heroic mythos. East Asians don't even really have the concept of the hero. You get it in Japan a little bit because they've been warring with each other for centuries, but there's no real concept of that in China and Korea. And these, you know, in this case, the woman has basically made these women into, you know, heroic warriors. And the songs are about them being queens and this kind of thing. And essentially it is the Western feminist heroic warrior defeating the old Korean patriarchy and its traditional theological conception of ancestor spirits. So all the East Asians, their theology is like very based in spirits, connection to the ancestors. And in Korean tradition, there's a lot of shamanism. And even today, there are 200 to 400,000 shamans. And you go to a shamanic ritual, you get yourself into this Dionysian state, and you're basically meant to put your grief and your bad feelings away. They go away in this ritual with the shaman. And, you know, that's how their tradition works. But in this film, it is being completely replaced by the Western conception of mythos and religiosity, even to the extent where the soldier boy sacrifices himself in a Christ-like way and they ascend to heaven like Jesus. I mean, I'll leave it there and I'll let you respond, but everywhere I was seeing a replacement of East Asian tradition with a Western conception. So I'll let you butt in and see what you think.
Well, Laura, before we answer that, what do you think about the woke stuff in it? Because obviously you're a mum of two girls and your girls have watched this film. You know, obviously you're very similar to myself in that you don't want your kids watching stuff that would leave them... or lead them, should I say, down the wrong path. What did you think in terms of woke propaganda.
Well, I think Nativist has raised some interesting points, but I think from, I mean, my perspective of the film is how is a film for my children who are white, who are Western, if we're allowed to use that word. So I think most of what you've said in regards to that perspective is irrelevant to them. I mean, so we have a TV in our house, but it's not connected to the TV, so we can't watch like BBC, ITV. We can put a film on or we can stream a TV show, but everything that my children watch, me and Sam have checked that it's okay. So we're also quite strict. Like I say, Sam watched this film and he was like, yeah, the kids can watch it. So we're also quite strict in the stuff that we won't let them watch and then the stuff that we will let them watch. And in K-pop Demon Hunters, it's nice to have a film where there's no diversity. It's just a country with a people and those people are of that country. There's no degeneracy or overly sexual things. There's no LGBT things. There's nothing from like the woke checklist, apart from maybe a bit of feminism, if you can say it's feminism. And I don't have a problem at all with my daughters watching films where there are strong, badass women. And I think before you have kids, you may be a little bit more idealistic and you're like, oh, you know, they're only going to do this and they're only going to do that. But then when you've got kids, you've got to be realistic about the world that they live in. And I don't open up my window every morning and it's, you know, Little House on the Prairie and everyone's baking bread and getting on and things like that. We live in a multicultural, diverse country where people hate you, people are mean, it's dangerous, all this stuff. And I want my girls to be tough. I want themselves to be able to handle, you know, mean people in the future and anything that might happen. I don't think they should have to. And maybe their daughters won't have to go through the same thing. But I want my girls to be able to stick up for themselves. And I don't think there's a problem with them watching a film where there are three, you know, badass young women fighting demons and singing about it. There's a million and one things that could be so much worse. So I don't have a problem with that element of feminism. Some people might disagree with that and say, you know, that's a bad thing for a nationalist to say. But I genuinely, you know, don't care if they're watching female warriors. I think that, my oldest, Catherine, who's four, she's quite feisty and I quite like that. You know, I quite like that she can stick up for herself. So I think it's positive in that regard. It's not teaching them to hate men. It's not teaching them that men and women are interchangeable. It's not teaching them, you know, any of the things that we usually call feminism out for. It's just teaching them to be strong, even if that is a physical strength. So for me, I don't see anything, maybe I don't see much that's woke with it. And the small amounts that are there, I don't have a problem with.
Well, I don't really know about sort of South Korean culture, but from a nationalist point of view, watching this film, there was many things within the film that I actually saw that I thought was very, very interesting, especially the idea that these sort of demons would walk amongst us, looking like us, subverting us. And in one of the songs, they even talk about the demons doing this, sort of hiding in plain sight. The demons, you know, essentially, well, they do. They take your soul. And they do this sort of in the film. They're doing this by sort of manipulating people through the media. And I like that as well. I mean, obviously, we talk a lot about Jewish power. Jewish power is something that we talk about a lot. But during this film, the demons themselves, I mean, they wear certain garments and they adorn themselves with certain trinkets and they have these hairstyles with little ringlets and they do look, in some ways, like caricatures of Jews. And I found this to have several things in it where the actual demons themselves were behaving in a way that we would look at and say, yeah, we understand this, because they take over the, you know, they produce their own boy band. This boy band is essentially people who were originally people but have done a deal with the demons and have sold their souls to the demons willingly. And they then manipulate the people. And I think in even one of the songs, they talk about the way the demons sway the masses and the way the demons control people. And I'm going to have to actually look up some of the lyrics to cite this, but I do find that very, very interesting. The idea that there's a film there for children about the way that they could be manipulated by celebrities, by pop stars. I thought that was a very, very interesting and wholesome point to make, because we often talk about the way sort of influencers, people within the media, have been used as poor role models to control people and lead them astray and lead them away from their culture. And this film sort of leans into the idea that there could be people there put on a pedestal to do exactly that. I don't know if any of you guys noticed that, but I thought that was a really interesting theme that many nationalists would sort of basically enjoy. And it's something we would agree with. We'll start with you, St. Harrison.
I think that was the main theme of the film that we noticed, you know, the black hats, they're using the media to take the souls of the population away. And then you had the fellow from the Soldier Boys, who basically sold his soul to the Jews and to get what he wanted, to get a better life, and he felt guilty for it because he cast off his family for his own greed. And as Nate has put earlier, he sacrificed himself at the end, whether that's out of guilt or the right thing to do. You make your own mind up. No, that was the key film of the key theme of the film. I think maybe it's not going to get picked up by your 4 and 6 year olds, but I think as time goes on, people are starting to see that more. And I think, especially over here, people will notice that connection more, especially one with the little small black hats. But I do know that the Koreans, particularly, again, Nativists might know more, have kind of sold their souls to the West. Although the Soldier Boys were named after the Korean Grim Reaper. Apparently, that's where the soldier comes from. But no, I think it's a good theme, and it's one that stands out throughout the film. I don't know how it managed to get past the people at Netflix who didn't watch that and go, hang on a minute, they look a bit familiar. This story's a bit close to the bone. Maybe no one will notice.
Well, even the idea of evil spirits for past sins is like a Western Judeo-Christian conception. I'm not an expert, but as far as I understand, within the East Asian theology, the spirits are always around. It's very connected with ancestry. Your ancestors are looking over you. Every solstice and New Year and, you know, every other public holiday, you go and participate in the rituals to the ancestors, you know, speak to them, let them know you're okay, etc. And, you know, particularly in that combination of metaphysics and Confucianism, they believe that the ancestors are watching over them. And the reason they don't do bad is because they don't want to dishonor their ancestors. Whereas the West is a guilt culture where we take responsibility for ourselves within ourselves. East Asia is a shame culture, and you never step out of line lest you be shamed by the collective. Now, what's interesting about Korea is it doesn't have anywhere near the same martial tradition as Japan. And since World War II, they've become an outpost of American imperialism and controlling the spread of communism. So they've adopted a huge amount of Western culture, the, you know, commercial aspects. Even Protestant Christianity is bloody everywhere in Korea. You've even got Baptist churches where they literally sing Baptist songs as if they were, you know, blacks in the south of America or something. It really is bizarre. Even the Talmud is a best-selling book in Korea. They are being completely destroyed and deracinated through the adoption of Western culture. And, you know, it's very evident in their birth rate now. It's like 0.7, 0.8. And they will likely go extinct in our lifetime. So I don't think they can get back from this situation. It's too far gone. The culture's just completely collapsed. Like, everywhere you go around, there's some feminist march, or, you know, they're crying about the Japanese sexually enslaving them, and like how many decades ago. You've got all this slave morality, this foreign religion, foreign commercialism, and they're falling apart as a nation. And, you know, this film does very well at demonstrating how they have completely adopted a foreign culture, and the delusion that's rising among Korean women that they are all queens and they're all deserving of, you know, some 10 out of 10 handsome K-pop boy is, you know, it's a major challenge of modern culture. And even Western women are falling for this stuff. You know, you've got all these Slavic girls that are obsessed with K-pop and K-drama. They even travel to Korea looking for a Korean boyfriend, and they get there and realize it's a lot different from the TV. So that's my little rant over for now. I'll let you respond.
Laura, what do you think about what I've said?
Yeah, there's a lyric, I've just got it up. When your patterns start to show, it makes a hatred want to grow out of my veins. Me and Sam have had a good laugh about that lyric before. And then there's, I think the one you mentioned, oh, you're the master of illusion. And then in Korean it says, don't try to deceive me. Look at all the masses that you're fooling.
So, yeah, that's the one. You're the master of illusion. Then the masses that you're fooling. When I heard that for the first time, that you're the master of illusion and it's the masses that you're fooling, that could literally be written about Hollywood. That could be written about Jewish Hollywood screenwriters. And I was blown away that that was in the film. I thought to myself, my God, you know, to actually have that in the film, I couldn't believe it was in there.
Well, it's quite clever because it talks about, because if you've not seen it, the demons have patterns like tiger stripes all over the body. So when it's talking about like the your patterns and when they start to show, but obviously patterns in a normal conversation, when your patterns start to show, it's like, you know, the things that you always do, I start to hate you when you do it. So it's quite clever how they've done it, really.
Well, I think that, and the idea that these people are twisting everyone's minds through the media, fooling the masses in order to take their souls. I mean, it's everything that we've talked about in terms of media manipulation. And there's one bit that I thought was particularly funny, because there's this demonic pigeon in the film, and the demonic pigeon lands, and it's got, you only see three of its eyes down part of its head, but it probably has three at the other side as well. And it lands. And one of the girls says, why is it wearing a little hat? And I just burst out laughing. The idea, this is a little demon. Why is he wearing a little hat? Why would the demon be wearing the little hat? Oh, my God. They've even said that. But for children today, there's not many films where, well, I think today more than ever, especially if you look at what's being put in things like the curriculum, obedience and adherence to the system and its mantra has never been so central to what's being taught in sort of British schools and institutions. And this is sort of leading a generation of young people down this route of destruction. And here you've got a film saying, you know, you're the masters of illusion. It's the masses that you're fooling. And I really like this. I like the idea, you know, little girls are being told there are people there who will offer you seemingly everything you want, that will come as friends, come as men that you might find attractive, But what they're offering you is actually your own destruction. And in this film, the stakes are pretty high as well. We're not talking about a small stakes here. We're talking about the destruction of everything, these demons taking your soul, and that they feed off you. And I really like that as well. I mean, that's another thing I would say about the media. You know, the media do feed off our souls. They do fool people. And once you're entranced by them, you lose who you are. And, you know, we call it brainwashing, but losing your soul is another apt way to put it. I mean, Laura, when your children are watching this, as a mum with young girls, I don't really see this as a feminist power fantasy. I more see this as kind of, you know, powerful young girls sort of rejecting the manipulation that was being forced upon them.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends how deep you want to look into it, but it's three young women fighting, so I suppose you could say, oh, it's a bit feminist because they're not at home barefoot in the kitchen, but it's not really. I mean, when I was a kid, it were Power Rangers, you know, and there was Pink Ranger, and all the girls wanted to be Pink Ranger, and we'd run around the playground at school pretending to kick each other and stuff. It didn't mean that we were watching feminist drama or whatever. So I don't really think it's feminist. I think you've been very strict if you say that it is.
What about the scene when they go to the old doctor and then shout at him like they know better? That was like their first interaction with a man, many years their senior, and they're just like, you know, give him an earful.
Wasn't he a fraudster, though, to be fair?
Yeah, he was. I mean, that was like a joke.
Yeah, but they didn't know that. They didn't know that.
But they did. That was the whole play of that was on the fact that the old doctor that one of them shouted at, and they did buy his medicine in the end, but he was basically selling people snake oil, wasn't he? You know, she was losing her voice because of conflicts within her. She was losing her voice for reasons that the film explains fully. But he sells her these sort of voice tonics, and they're basically grape juice that he's stuck stickers over. And that's how he's making his living. And I don't know. I mean, you could say, you know, that's people rejecting the old ways, rejecting the old herbal medicines, you know, making fun of sort of spiritual healers. But I kind of thought that was a bit of sort of lighthearted kind of like nonsense in the film, where, you know, you go to some old quack doctor who prescribes you a load of nonsense and it just turns out to be grape juice. You know, I mean,
yeah, he's basically Ricky Doolin. You're allowed to show it.
Oh, I mean, that's harsh. I mean, in East Asian culture, reverence for the ancestors is extremely strict. So that scene was actually shocking to me.
I think that they're more excitable. Like, I didn't watch that and think, oh, you lot were really rude. I felt like they were just being a bit silly and excitable.
I mean, I got so into the Japanese honor culture that by the end of the trip, I was disgusted by the Europeans that weren't observing it. It was a particularly memorable moment where some old Spanish boomer women came into a cafe and they just left all their shit all over the table, didn't clean it up, and I was absolutely fuming. Sort of caught eyes with the Japanese woman next to me in disgust. It was quite a moment, but yeah, that one shocked me. And, you know, basically every male character is a bad person in the film. You know, you got the doctor selling snake oil, the organizers, this, you know, fake status obsessed idiot, and then, you know, the sergeant boys, the demons. It's like, it's not, you know, not saying a lot about the goodness of man and tradition, is it?
But it is a man who sacrifices himself at the end for the girls. And also it is a film for girls. Like, you know, you have your films where the men are the heroes and, you know, they're off conquering things and there are no women in it apart from if it's just love interest on the side. And I think it's okay for women to for young girls to have their films where it's for girls and it's all about girls. I mean, their manager's a man. Is he the one that you said was status obsessed?
Yeah, he's a little snake.
He's a bit goofy, isn't he? But I think he's quite a popular character. You know, you can buy figures of him and stuff. And like I say, it is the main Sarger boy that turns good at the end and sacrifices himself. But I just think it's a film for girls, and it's okay to have that sometimes.
One thing that we can work out is Rumi's like half demon, half normal. Is this because her dad was a demon and her mum race mixed?
That was my reading. That like she's got half a, you know, demon in her because of her absent father or something. Very
interesting. Well, that's one interesting bit about the film. The one bit about the film which could be said to be sort of multiracial propaganda is the hero isn't pure, and the hero or the central character of the film is hiding the fact that she is actually half demon. I mean, how would you, you know, that was something in it. But so, okay, for people who haven't watched it, the complexity of the film is there are demons and they are led by this huge sort of monstrous entity called, is it Gemi? Is that how it's pronounced? Does anyone want to help me with this? Anyone going to help me with this, how the pronunciation?
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think it's Gemi is the way it's pronounced. It's like this giant ethereal flame that feeds on souls. And he is served by demons that help him in his... It's spelled Gwima. I'm gonna have a look at this and say pronunciation. So to see if I'm getting this right, because I don't want to do an entire thing and be getting his Gwima.
The Gwi sounds like Israel.
Gwima. Gu-i-ma is how it's saying. The gui sounds like gu-i, similar to the word we with a hard G. Gwima. That's how it sounds. Right. So his name's Gwima, and he's this giant sort of ethereal flame creature that feeds on souls. And surrounding him, he has all of these demons, which are nefarious creatures of pure evil. But to manipulate people in the real world, him and the demons, they do take people's souls and they do kill people. But Gwima has the ability to grant people wishes. And it's almost like a Faustian pact they enter into. And he gives them the riches, the wealth, etc. But then they sign over their soul to him. And along the way, they have to sacrifice something. So when they are given whatever they wish for, they have to leave things behind that they love. So the main Sarger boy character, Jinu, he was a talented bard who was struggling, and he did a deal with Gwima, and the deal was that he would be noticed and he would play for royalty in Korea. But as he played for royalty in Korea, he would have everything he wanted. He'd sleep on silk sheets. He'd have all the beautiful women, all the food he could eat. But his mother and sister, he'd have to leave them behind to essentially starve. And it's sacrificing something that you love to get what you want, giving up on the people or something important to yourself in order to get something else that you want in the process of selling your soul. And these people then are basically controlled by Gwima. They're controlled by him, and he has power over them, and they have to do what he says, or he can cause them pain, etc. But they're not necessarily evil through and through like the pure demons are. And the Sarger boys are all humans who at one point or another have sold their souls. So there's actually quite a complex situation there, where once you are a human that has sold his soul, you can return to the human world as a human, but you exhibit from time to time these patterns, and these patterns on your skin show that you've sold your soul to the demons, and that you are in effect part demon, because although you're still walking around in human skin, your soul is now under the control of Guima. Now, Rumi, the main female character, had patterns, but she didn't have patterns because she sold her soul. She had patterns because her mother, who was of the previous heroes, had basically either slept with somebody, presumably had slept with someone who at one point or another had sold their soul to the demons. Now, this might be out of trickery. She might have known that she was sleeping with this person and shouldn't have. But it does throw in this kind of idea that the hero is not pure. The hero is some kind of mix, because she had at some point been tainted by the demons, and this could be seen as race mixing propaganda. Did any of you guys see it as race mixing?
It's almost as if the writer is a race mixer herself. Following nativist wisdom, the writer female always makes herself the hero.
Is the writer in a race mixed relationship?
She grew up in the West and she married a white man, so you know her children are mixed. I mean, is that the female writers always do this? They always make themselves one of the characters.
What did you think of that, Laura? The idea that there's sort of race mixing propaganda in there, because I didn't really see it as that. It's more sort of a taint, but I think it could be interpreted in that way.
I mean, the demons are Korean as well, so the humans are Korean and the demons are Korean. I wouldn't say that it was race mixing propaganda. I'd say it's the equivalent of, you know, someone like a demigod like Hercules or Perseus or something, who's half god, half human. It's closer to that than it is race mixing, I'd say, because everyone's still Korean.
I think it's an allegory of her own personal race mixing.
Now, another interesting part of the film is, by the end, the girls learn to accept that they're not perfect and that Rumi isn't perfect. Now, some of this could be seen as sort of females accepting that they're not going to be perfect. And that can be bad. You see, with some of this, there's actually nuance, and the lines are quite interesting when you're talking about this, because I don't want my daughter to want to be perfect to the point where she's ashamed of small imperfections. But equally, you don't want your daughter to embrace some kind of feminism where she thinks being a fat, ugly hog monster is acceptable because everybody's beautiful. Now, where does the line lie in this? Because for me, the girls who were in this were drawn to be very, very attractive, very athletic, they're very heroic. They put themselves on the line, their own lives on the line to save others. They're constantly fighting these monsters to stop people from losing their souls. So they are heroic characters that girls can look up to. But by the end, they're heroic characters that have accepted that they do have flaws. And the last song is about accepting those flaws and understanding that you're beautiful in spite of minor flaws. Where is the line there between sensibly accepting that you'll never be perfect, but you can still be good and heroic and strong with imperfections, and being sort of body positive and feminist? Where does that line fall? I'm going to throw that to Laura first, because I think that's an interesting question for a woman.
Yeah, I think there are things about yourself that you can change. You know, if you want to have a better body, you can eat healthy and exercise, but then there are things about yourself that you probably can't change. Me and Mark keep saying it, but as parents of daughters, you don't want them to be insecure about certain things. I mean, my oldest went down a slide the other day and the slide was way too fast, and she ended up banging a lip at the bottom, and she had a little cut, a little like scab on her lip. And she said the other day, I don't want to go out because people will laugh at me, because she had this tiny like little cut above her lip. And she was talking to Sam at the time, and Sam was like, no, you know, you're beautiful, and people are not going to laugh at you for having a little cut. And, you know, we all get cuts sometimes, and it'll go soon. And you want your children to be confident. And if they do have a, you know, a slight little quote unquote flaw, you want them to just embrace that and be okay, and just get out there. So with the patterns, obviously that wasn't something that Rumi could change. It was part of who she was, and it wasn't, I don't think it's saying to people, you know, don't strive for improvement. It's just saying, you know, if there is something that you consider to be a flaw, maybe try to embrace it. And again, it's one of those things, you know, I said earlier, I think before having kids, people are, I know I was, a bit more idealistic. But then when you have them and you're dealing with the reality of raising these kids and wanting them to be safe and happy all the time, you maybe change your mind a little bit and be a bit more realistic about things. So I think anything where it's like, anything where it's teaching kids to be confident and love themselves, and accept. I mean, my daughter's got freckles as well. And since she's been born, I've always taught her, you know, your freckles are so beautiful. I wish I had as many freckles as you. And it's things like that. You want your kids to be confident. So I think that can sometimes be a nice message. It depends on what it's telling you to accept.
Go on, nativist. You're the anti. You're the man. You're the man here who pulls these things to pieces. Was this sort of an embrace of feminism, or was this a positive message that young girls don't have to strive to ridiculous levels to please other people?
Not sure how I'd answer that. I mean, there's certainly a lot of ambition among the girls, and, you know, the lyrics are about being a queen the whole time. But in response to Laura's point about wanting children to be happy, I understand that bullying is exceptionally bad in East Asian schools. I think they're very low empathy and so status oriented that, and they don't have this Christian ethical system, and that kind of thing happens. I mean, I'm just really trying to get across the kind of East Asian mentality and neurological profile, how they really are. I mean, I don't think this is as much damaging to a Western audience as it is to the Korean audience. So that's how I'll answer that one.
What do you think, St. Harrison?
Well, I didn't think there's anything too bad about it. I mean, yeah, people do have imperfections, but then if your kid's got something wrong with them, that you just say, look, Beethoven was deaf, he was a composer, Stephen Hawking was a spastic, and he's one of the cleverest people alive, so not all hope is lost.
He's not alive anymore, is he?
Well, no, he had a good go.
Well, I think having a young girl and understanding that young girls are essentially very, very conscious of how they look and how other people will perceive them. So, you know, you might be getting your daughter ready for a party or to go to something, and her hair might be a little different that day, or something small is wrong with her outfit. And they can fixate on these small things that you would otherwise think as pointless. And they can get really, really upset about them. I know my daughter does sometimes. Sometimes, you know, she'll have a new pair of something like, pair of leggings, and you're sort of going out to a soft play place, and she'd be like, I look ridiculous, there's crinkles in these leggings because they're too long. And you're like, look, the other ones are too small for you, darling, you've grown out of them. these ones are a tiny bit too big because you're not quite big enough for the new size, but you're definitely too big for the old size. You're like, I look ridiculous. They're all crinkly. Everyone's going to laugh at me. You're like, look, nobody's going to laugh at you, darling. And I do think there is something important in today's world to telling young women that you don't have to be literally perfect. I do think, however, that has gone too far. So I think what's happened is feminists have seized upon you don't have to be perfect, and they've taken it to health at every size. Everybody's beautiful. We're all special. You know, we're all individual snowflakes, which are so unique and wonderful and perfect in our own way. Now, that's obviously not true. There is always going to be somebody who is more beautiful. There's always somebody who's going to be stronger, faster, more intelligent. Not everyone is just perfect the way they are. But I think teaching people to accept themselves, their limitations, and not to get caught up on smaller things is important, especially in a world full of people today who are being taken for a ride by these influencers. And I think that's another thing that I found quite interesting about the film, is it did sort of shine a light on the ideas of people who live their life on social media and have to live up to certain expectations, and how in reality that might seem fun, but it's almost impossible to live up to. And we do see this in the modern world. I've seen stories about couples. You've spoken to people who've been in restaurants, and a couple will come in to the restaurant. They'll look unhappy. They'll have big sort of comfy like hoodie things on. They'll be playing on their phones. They'll be barely saying a word to each other. And then all of a sudden, they'll take the big hoodies off. They'll be hidden out of view. They'll put these big smiles on. The food will come out. They'll start taking pictures of the food, themselves with the food, each other, you know, raising glasses of champagne. Then as soon as the performative act of enjoying the food for the cameras has been completed, they basically put back on the big comfy hoodies. You know, they let their hair down. They begin uploading everything to social media and barely say a word to each other again for the rest of the meal before they leave. And they live through this lens, and everything is curated to look perfect and appear perfect, but it's anything but perfect. It's all an act. And I do think in today's world, there is an immense amount of pressure heaped on young people not to be the best. So when I was younger, the pressures on people were, if you're a young man, it was to do well at sport, to do well academically. It was to grow up and embody certain facets that, you know, your parents would approve of. But today, the pressures on people are so much greater, I think. The pressures are to be almost perfect all of the time. Because when you go on social media, you see this view of other people, and it's this idealized view of them. And I even know parents who do this. They take their children out and they pose them for pictures for social media. So the day out isn't about everyone having a good time. It's about posing for pictures for social media so that they can look good on Instagram in front of their friends, and it looks like they've got the perfect family life. And I think one of the messages in this film, with Rumi and her patterns showing, was that she wasn't perfect, but she always had to present herself as perfect for the public and for those around her. And it made her live an uncomfortable life. So you see at certain points, she chooses clothes that specifically cover the demon patterns on her body. And this makes her self-conscious because she's always having to put on this show. And I think that has real merit, especially when you have a young daughter, because I do think the pressures on people today not only are much greater than they've ever been, but they're also very unfair, because the world that we look at through the lens of social media is often unattainable, which means if you're trying to live your life in that way, you essentially are faking it. And if you want to keep up with those who are faking it, it means you have to fake it yourself. And one of the things I liked about the end of the film is when the girls finally defeat Guima, they embrace each other and they realize we do our best. We're good at what we do. We try hard, but we'll never be completely perfect. And those little imperfections kind of make us who we are, and they make us human. Is that a bad message? We'll start with you, St. Harrison.
It's not a bad message, no. But wasn't she just covering up her marks because she was a demon hunter, or essentially, whilst being a demon herself? That's like being a copper with stolen Cadbury's mini eggs in your back pocket.
Well, sort of, but she had to show that she was perfect at all times, and she wouldn't even admit to those who were closest to her that this was an issue. So there was always sort of distrust, falseness, and this barrier between her and those she was closest to, because she was trying to keep up appearances.
Oh, no, I agree that people like in the public eye do need to keep up appearances and pretend that everything's nice. Like, even like we see in Dubai at the moment, as it's getting bombed by rockets, all the slag influencers are there posing still on their balconies, trying to make out everything's all lovely and nice when you know it ain't. But no, I think it's a good message, and you could tell, like, how they showed after the show, so like they were so happy just to get into their like normal clothes and just relax and just ignore everything, and how annoyed they were that they had to suddenly get dressed because she'd released that new single. So I think if you do have kids and you're watching it with them, yeah, explain that everything you see on social media is inevitably fake.
Nativist, am I totally wrong? Tell me how I'm wrong and I'm being a cuck.
No, talking of people living their life through social media, I was witness to a woman that came into a kind of cafe thing, buys a salad, and then she filmed herself with the salad for 9 minutes. I am not exaggerating. At one point, she even tried to balance the camera on the pepper, and then the pepper fell on her little miniature dog. It was really quite remarkable, and that's unfortunately how a lot of people are living their lives now. But yeah, East Asian cultures are incredibly status-oriented and competitive. There's an awful lot of pressure on being perfect that comes from the parents, the school, peers, whatever. And, yeah, it's not a very nice situation to be in. In South Korea, they have one exam on one day over a 10 or 12-hour period, in which they close the roads so that there are no excuses for people being late. And your result in that exam basically decides the rest of your life trajectory, what university you'll go to, whether you'll get an elite job at Samsung or LG or whatever. And, you know, that's what it's like. And the more inegalitarian a society is, you know, the more capitalist it is, the less Christian or whatever other social tool different cultures use, the more pressure there is to, you know, compete and get to the top of that hierarchy. And I don't think it's any way to live. You know, you should, I know boomers always say to their kids, oh, just do what you enjoy, follow your passion. I think boomers go too far and basically encourage their kids to study rubbish that's not even useful. But in life, you should try and become a master of something that really motivates you, and don't just live for other people's approval. And I think that is the great tragedy of East Asian culture, is most people are just living for the approval of their parents. And, you know, they'll go to the grave wishing they actually did something that was more interesting to them.
Go on, Laura. set native is straight.
Well, I was just going to say, just very quickly, that, yeah, like a lot of things that you look at online are just fake. I thought he was going to say that woman spent 9 minutes taking a photo of her salad, and then when she'd uploaded it online, she ordered a burger or something instead. But, yeah, everything's fake, and that's something you need to teach your kids as well, just to always sort of read between the lines and don't believe everything that you see online. I mean, even people Photoshop themselves, don't they, so that they look different, and then you see someone in real life and you're like, Jesus, you don't look anything like your profile picture. But yeah, I have to go now, unfortunately, because of childcare, so I'll just finish up if that's all right. And
give us a score, Laura, and then I'll be texting Sam to give you a good thrashing for leaving the stream early.
I think it's a film that doesn't take itself too seriously, and I don't think that we should take it too seriously either. It's not a pretentious film. It's a bit goofy and silly. And we didn't actually mention that they I don't know if you guys want to talk about this when I drop off, but they didn't expect it to be anywhere near as big as it was. And there's no merchandise or anything. I mean, you can buy T-shirts with the logo and the characters on now, but there's no toys or anything like that. And parents are crying out for K-pop Demon Hunters toys because their kids are wanting them so bad. But they just did not expect it to be anywhere near as big as it was. And I like that about it. I like that it's a bit of an underdog. And I'm glad that it won the Oscars, because the Oscars are just terrible nowadays. And I mentioned at the start, you know, sometimes I think it's okay to be a little bit cringy and embrace the cringe. And I think that's what we're doing with this film, really, you know, getting into the songs and just having a good time. So, yeah, I'm going to give it 7 out of 10. I don't think it's an amazing film, but I think it's a pretty good film. And I don't mind watching it, and I don't mind having my kids watch it either. Oh, one other thing as well, people who are seriously into K-pop are like, K-pop Demon Hunters isn't real K-pop, you know, because when something becomes really popular, everyone's suddenly too cool to like it. Like when a band becomes popular or a film becomes popular. But again, that's an element of, I don't think it takes itself too seriously, and it is massive, but it's okay to still enjoy it. So yeah, 7 out of 10 from me. And I'll listen to the rest of the stream tomorrow. It was nice talking to all three of you, and I hope everyone who's listening has a good evening. And I'll probably be back with Mark on the stream soon, and we'll be at Nuneaton
next Sunday. You'll be back, yeah. And I don't expect you to cry off early that night, because we'll have a lot to talk about, because we've just got back from Nuneaton.
Yeah, that'll be good. All right, then. Okay, good evening, everyone. See you soon.
Right, thanks so much, and see you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Right, Nativist. So I want to talk about this, because you've raised some really interesting points, and you've raised a lot of things that I'm not saying that the things you raised haven't been important, okay, because they are, and they're obviously very well researched. However, I do want to ask you this. You've spoken about a lot of things that I didn't know about, and I can't really argue with you about them either, because they're things like the things about Korean or sort of Japanese or Oriental culture, which I simply don't know about. So I was going to ask you...
Unless it's Nintendo.
Well, I know a lot about Nintendo, but I don't know a lot about Japanese culture. But I was going to ask you, mate, and this is quite important to what we're talking about. You know, I appreciate your input so far, but what do you think about this film for Western girls? I'm not talking about, you know, your rating or anything for Korean audiences, but obviously my daughter, you know, little English girl, Laura's daughters, little English girls. What do you think about this film as an influence on them? Do you think it was good or bad? And obviously, what do you think about the analogy that we drew between sort of the demons and the people who own the media?
I mean, I said it already. I don't think it's as damaging to a Western audience as it is to a domestic Korean audience. Because my reading of it is essentially trashing their traditional metaphysics, traditional patriarchal shamanic culture. And really, to a Western audience, it's not much different than you know, the usual girl boss narratives. And yeah, I appreciate what you and Laura are saying. It's very difficult, and you want your daughter to be confident, and you've only got a narrow choice of themes to choose from or whatever. But yeah, where was I going with this? One thing I am particularly concerned about, though, is this new obsession with K-pop, K-drama that a lot of Western European women are now into. They're really kind of idolizing this archetype of like the shiny skinned Korean femboy. They really revere Korean culture without knowing anything about it. In fact, it's really all fake. It's all just spectacle, show, looking cool. There's no depth to it. And you know, I saw this when I was in Korea. There were a lot of kind of Slavic looking girls, just seemed to be living there. There were a lot of European couples, but of all the European couples I saw, it was the exact same relationship polarity where it's the, you know, Anglo girl leading her taller, better looking boyfriend around, and he's the lapdog. You could just sense the energy, and that was every single European couple that were there together. And I guarantee they're sitting at home watching K-drama and maybe even listening to the K-pop stuff. And this is very popular now. I posted on my Telegram earlier, BTS are using a white woman in their latest video. And they're singing in English. So this is now a Korean soft power play. It's an industrial complex. It's being sent around the world. And these Korean men, because they're faced with feminism on their own doorstep, they're now marrying these white girls from Russia, Ukraine, maybe Poland, wherever else. And you even see content from women that go to South Korea, Seoul. They've been watching all this stuff on Netflix, expecting to find the shiny skin twink boyfriend, and they realize it's just a shit old concrete jungle, and actually a lot of the people are ugly and fat and not tall, and they've been living this whole fantasy lie for, you know, however many years as one of their favorite hobbies through the smartphone, whatever. So I'm very concerned about this, you know, internationalization of, you know, fancy archetypes that really have no bearing in reality. And women are living their whole, you know, existence through these fantasies. It's a huge problem. A lot of, especially young girls, are idealizing these fantasies and, you know, even traveling to Korea, even getting Asian boyfriends and stuff. And, you know, they've completely turned against their own men in the same way that Korean women have turned against theirs.
But is this not down to how, firstly, our media over here or in the West is absolutely awful? So people are having to turn to the East, where the content is more homogenous and, dare I say it, nicer, easier to watch. You know, you have to read it after time. So in escaping from the crap that we've had over here pushed for the last 30 odd years, they've now been, like you say, trapped into falling for the Korean side of things or the Far East, in the same way that all the boomer women fled to Turkey and Africa to find husbands because they were told for a while that, oh, find yourself a nice Turkish husband, he'll be nice. Find yourself a nice African husband, he'll be nice. Not realising the dangers that come with that. It's going to be the same with them turning over to, or going over to the Far East to find themselves a husband and realising it's not all it's cracked up to be. It's simply because each country has failed its own people in terms of what content they're given.
I would definitely accept that point in terms of Japan and their anime, their cultural output, which is also a soft power play. So, you know, Japanese anime is, you know, very traditional, very honor-based. The girls are hyper-feminine. The men are all extremely heroic, totally dutiful. You know, and I've enjoyed watching some of that myself, and I can understand why that's popular. But people need to get their head around that Korea and Japan are incredibly different. Japan basically were warring with each other for over 1,000 years, just constant feudal conflict between the different daimyos, and then they went into this period of peace in around 1600. But the warrior class, the samurai, became the scholar class, the bureaucratic class. And then when they modernized after the Meiji Revolution, restoration, they essentially became the capitalist class as well, which is why Japan went on to absolutely dominate new technology industry in the 60s, 70s, and 80s until America nipped them in the bud. But Korea just doesn't have any of that. It didn't have the same martial culture. It was, you know, the administrative class were, you know, Confucian in outlook, but they didn't really have as much control over the people, and the people were just these shamanic peasants. And they didn't have that strong foundation. And now they've been westernized. It's just completely fallen apart into this fake status worshiping nonsense and importing this westernism. And, you know, it's destroying them at breakneck speed. And yeah, you know, I don't think the South Korean state will survive. They'll collapse and either get invaded by the North Koreans or the Japanese. I'm pretty confident that they've gone too far. It's just too feminized now. The women are in complete rebellion. They've got no respect. So, yeah, that's the way I see it.
But you can understand why they're marketing to the Western audience, because they know the Western audience is sick of seeing Ngubu and Sharon getting it on together on telly. So, like, look, the white people over there, they're quite clearly sick of seeing the black and browns on the telly. Let's give them some decent-ish music, depending on your taste. Some nice whitish people, happy couples. We'll take all their money so they stop watching their own crap. So you can't blame them for trying to capture our audience as well, even though it's at the detriment of ours and theirs.
Well, it's just the nature of capitalism, really, to try and, you know, expand to every possible frontier, conquer every market. And yeah, I do think you're tapping into something. Like, a lot of the girls say that the attraction of the Korean man is that he is both a shiny-faced, youthful beauty who's also tall and chiseled or whatever, but they also have the values of a gentleman. They're very polite. They're very dutiful and serving and all this kind of thing, but I think they find that when they're actually faced with the real thing, it's not the same as on the TV. So yeah, it's all fake, I think.
So which do you think has more longevity, South Korea or North Korea?
North Korea, without a doubt. I mean, they're replacing themselves. They're not. I think they're around a replacement birth rate. But South Korea is so bad. It's like they've had a slight bump recently. 2 years ago it was 0.7, now it's 0.8. But they've been so low for so long that there just aren't many people around in the younger age brackets. And you know, every two generations they're gonna lose like 90% of their population over two generations in the younger age bracket. So I really don't know how they can reverse it now with their culture being so deracinated. I mean, North Korea is slightly deracinated as well because they've, you know, imported, you know, German Jewish kind of political system, but you know, the state authority is still there. And, you know, even when Michael Palin went to North Korea a few years ago, it genuinely seemed as though they had like a communal warm culture. I mean, I know they only show you the best bits for the camera, but there, I think there have even been reports of North Koreans escaping to the South because they're in such bad economic conditions. And then they decide to go back because they want the warmth of the culture back. So, yeah, I know the West loves to hype up South Korea as a success story, but I think it's one of the worst cultures I've ever been to, quite honestly. It's nothing like Japan, and it really solidified in my mind the idea that the martial honor, you know, patriarchy and duty and honor to the self-sacrifice to the collective is everything. It's everything in politics and culture. So that's really what they're lacking. But have either of you seen any of the other kind of Korean stuff? Like, for example, there's this director called Celine Song, and she's done two films recently. One is called Past Lives, and another called The Materialists, and they're very focused on relationships. And Western critics, like, glaze them so hard and being like, oh, it's such a clever parody of materialism and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, no. Like, these Westerners have completely misunderstood. This is a Korean woman who's directed her own view of the world. And the Western audience are like, oh, so clever, you know, such a parody. I don't see it like that at all. And also Parasite, another Korean film, did very well, won the Oscar for Best Picture. People, again, were calling that a parody. And my reading was it's a critique of Korean culture. Again, the Western critics said, oh, it's, you know, a critique of classism, blah, blah, blah. No, that literally is what Korean culture is. So, yeah, I don't know if you've seen any of them.
I've heard of it, but I've not seen it.
No, I haven't. Look, we're going to do the Super Chats now, and then we'll move towards the end of the show, because obviously Laura's already gone. So let's do these Super Chats. Anglo-Papist subscribed for $5. Thank you so much. Open Borders for Israel gave $5. Thank you so much. And said, there is a free movie on YouTube called Lansky, about Maya Lansky, the Jewish mobster, that could be good for you to watch and review. Well, thank you so much. John gave $100. Thank you so much. And said, best wishes. D. Deirdrix gave $15 and made a one-month subscriber streak. Thank you so much. Caribou gave $8 and said, thanks, Laura. I enjoyed it. Well, thank you very much. A Disembodied Voice gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, are we doing Super Chats? Sorry, I'm not into K-pop whatsoever. Mark, we know Reform are cucks, but normally see Reform as hardcore. If Reform get in, will the public discourse lean rightwards? And will space open up for our ideas, or will they stymie us? I think there's an interesting question. We can all answer that. But I think the thing with Reform is Reform are not us. They're not who we want to be. But many of their supporters are us. And that's really the interesting thing. So many of the people who support Reform are on exactly the same page as we are, which is, you know, exactly where we want to be. You know, we want to be with that level of support. But unfortunately, they're supporting Reform. And you have to ask, why do they do that? Well, they support Reform and not us for several reasons. The first is that Reform are credible. They can win. And secondly, although many people feel the same way as we feel, they're scared of being called racist. And that's a real issue for most people. Now, if you went out and said, look, I'm voting BNP, I'm voting National Front, there is the immediate accusation of racism. But if, however, you say you're voting for Reform, or back in the day, if you said you were voting for UKIP, it's much harder for you to be tainted in that same way. So although a lot of their supporters feel the same way as us, they themselves at the top aren't the same as us, but they do present an electable face that people feel as if they can openly identify with without losing social capital. Now, if Reform won, I don't think they'd do everything we want by a long way. However, I do think they would serve an important purpose, and that purpose would be to smash the old two-party system, specifically the Conservatives. Now, when it comes down to it, that in itself would be a massive thing. To resign one of the two major parties to the history books would be massive. And that's what really we need to start with, changing the political landscape before we can make real progress. However, I do think there would be a couple of good things that would come from this. I think Reform wouldn't be as hot on things like digital ID. I think Reform wouldn't be as hot on things like the abolition of jury trials. And I think it would cause discourse to open up. And I also think you would get rogue factions within Reform, like the Rupert Lowe faction, because that's where he came from, that would openly talk about ethno-nationalist ideas. So I don't think it would be perfect by a long way, but it would be something that we could gain some capital from. But and if you ask me, would I prefer a Reform government or a Conservative or Labour government? It's a no-brainer. I'd prefer a Reform government. Ideally, Rupert Lowe's Restore Party would be bigger and they would be the ones leading the charge. But I don't think they will be. I think Farage will continue to dominate that space. What do you guys think about that? You know, would you be enthusiastic about a Reform government?
Well, it's the least worst option at the moment, isn't it? And then I was reading something today or yesterday that although Reform has quite a big backing from like the over 30s, Restore is doing far better amongst like university age people. So the younger people are skipping past the whole civic nationalism now and just advocating for what we want, which is nice.
Yeah, I'm all in Restore. Hope they can cause an upset and really take over that right-wing nationalist position.
Well, thank you. We've got one more super chat. Mr. Smalls 14, he said, he gave $5 and said micro dono to the rescue. We have had some good donations tonight, but thank you so much for adding to them. It is very much appreciated. Anyway, that brings us to about the end of the stream. We're ending it a little bit early because Laura's gone, so the debate is over. Does everyone want to give it a score out of 10 and their final thoughts? So we'll start with you, St. Harrison, then Nativist, then I'll end it, and then we'll wrap things up.
Yeah, I went into this film having never seen it, nor never wanted to see it, but came out enjoying it more than I thought I would. And Mrs. St. Harrison enjoyed it well, so I think I need to delete it off the laptop before I get to sit through it again. But no, I'll give it a... I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10. If you've got kids, let them watch it. If you don't have kids, don't be gay. Don't watch it.
Production, pacing, story, all fine. Probably give it a 6 out of 10 on that alone. But as I say, it's one of the most subversive, nationally destructive things I've ever seen. And I hope the good Koreans can save their nation, because if they can continue down this path of Westernism, they'll destroy themselves.
Well, I'm going to give the film, as a kid's film, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. I really enjoyed it. It wasn't a perfect film, and for little girls, I think it's pretty good. I don't think it pushes any of the narratives that Western films push. I think the narratives it does push are ones that could be seen in some ways as analogous to the things we talk about, especially the idea of people presenting in the people being presented by the media, leading people astray and stealing their souls. I think there's a lot that can be said about that. I enjoyed the film and the songs are pretty catchy. So yeah, that's my take. Anyway, That brings us to the end of the stream for tonight. Sorry it's ending a little early, but Laura had to go. Guys, do you want to give you good nights and then we'll end things?
Yeah, thanks for having us and see you all next month. Have a good month.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope my input was valuable and people will see the truth about the East Asians. So, yeah, see you next month and have a good week ahead.
Well, thanks so much. A lot of people have said your takes were really interesting tonight, Nativist, so thank you so much for that. Thank you to everyone. Thank you to St. Harrison. Thank you to Nativist. Thank you to everybody who donated so generously. And thank you to everyone who tuned in. We'll be back next month for another film club, and I'll be back on Wednesday night with Mike Enoch for Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody, and good night.